Senator Elizabeth Warren campaigns in Cincinnati today with Hillary Clinton. It's their first joint appearance on the presidential campaign trail, and it comes amid all the speculation that Clinton is considering the progressive Massachusetts senator as her running mate. But as WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks tells us, don't count on it.
There are a number of reasons why Clinton should pick Elizabeth Warren, if you ask Andrew Green, the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Last week, he published an editorial with the title, "The Case for Clinton Warren." Reason number one, Green says Clinton needs to reach progressives and tap into the kind of political passion that fueled Bernie Sanders' campaign.
And Elizabeth Warren certainly could help do that, in that she hits a lot of the same issues that Senator Sanders does in terms of income inequality, that the system is rigged against regular people. And she has the intellectual and policy chops to really make those cases and has been doing so very well for years.
Another important reason to pick Warren, according to Green, she's a good person to have by your side in a fight.
Senator Warren has shown herself to be a really exquisite attack dog against Donald Trump.
Indeed, Warren seems to delight in this role, which is an important one for a running mate to take on. Here she is recently at the New Hampshire State Democratic Convention, where she launched a blistering takedown of Donald Trump.
Every day, it becomes clearer that he is a thin-skinned, racist bully. And every day, it becomes clearer he will never be president of the United States.
Warren frequently engages Trump on Twitter, calling him a bully who spews hate-filled lies. Trump calls her goofy and Pocahontas, a reference to the controversy surrounding her claims of Native American heritage. Here's Trump earlier this month in Richmond, Virginia.
Pocahontas, I'm doing such a disservice to Pocahontas. It's so unfair to Pocahontas. But this Elizabeth Warren, I call her goofy, Elizabeth Warren, she's one of the worst senators in the entire United States Senate, and I hope she's going to be chosen by Hillary. Oh, would that be great? I would love it.
But there are reasons why that might not happen. Though they're campaigning together in Ohio today, Warren and Clinton haven't always been very close. Warren did not endorse Clinton. She remained neutral during the primary fight against Bernie Sanders. And in her 2003 book, Warren said Clinton's cozy connections with Wall Street caused her to flip her position on the overhaul of the country's bankruptcy laws. And if Clinton were to tap Warren, she would risk losing support from Wall Street donors. But Barney Frank, the former Massachusetts congressman and a Clinton supporter, says picking a woman to run with would be a bold step in a political season that demands boldness.
For Hillary Clinton to do something which would be very unconventional, a two-woman ticket, whereas in the past that might have been a problem, I think would benefit her. It would help shadow this inaccurate stereotype that she's too timid.
On the other hand, a ticket of two Northeastern liberals would lack geographic or ethnic balance, an argument that might prompt Clinton to pick someone like HUD Secretary Julian Castro, who has a reputation as a rising Latino political star. But it's important to remember that this doesn't come down only to whether Clinton wants Warren to be her vice president.
It's really about, does Elizabeth Warren want to be vice president? And I think if you're a progressive Democrat, you hope the answer to that is no.
Susan Tracy is a former Democratic state rep and a president of the strategy group in Boston. She says Warren is better off staying put in the Senate.
You know, she's really taken on the torch from Ted Kennedy. She has so much power and so much influence and such an important role to play in progressive politics. And quite honestly, I think that would be lost as a vice president.
But the speculation will continue today as Clinton and Warren campaign together in Cincinnati. And however unlikely a Clinton-Warren ticket is, that speculation helps both of them. It allows Clinton to say to progressives, hey, I'm considering one of your champions as my running mate. And it allows Warren to raise a very high political profile even higher. For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks.
Big Poppy. Red Sox slugger David Ortiz got a hit in his only at-bat yesterday in the Red Sox 6-2 loss to the Rangers. Poppy is having a great year with a .337 batting average, 18 home runs, and even two stolen bases. Ortiz announced before the season started that this year would be his final year in the majors, with it becoming harder for him to prepare his aging body and aching feet for each day's game. WBUR commentator Bill Littlefield is also wondering whether Poppy would have been better off if he kept it quiet.
He wishes that he'd never told the world what he would do, or wouldn't is more like it, for he said that he'd be through with this grand game he's played for years, the game that's made him rich and also made him famous and beloved, this game which will end for him as autumn brings cool breezes, falling leaves. The he of whom I speak is David Big Poppy Ortiz. In Boston, he's been hitting like few older men have hit. He also charmed the customers with what has passed for wit when he picked up the microphone and shouted to the skies that Boston was our bleeping town. To no one's great surprise, that shout has been remembered, celebrated, and repeated. The standings notwithstanding, Boston will not be defeated, as far as Poppy is concerned, and who's to say him nay? It was what people wanted in the ballpark on that day when Poppy told whatever bad guys might have been around that Boston was, well, as he put it, it's our bleeping town. But now his days at Fenway dwindle, even as his hits sail over and bang off the wall, and he is at his wit's end. Or somewhere close, for he has told us he's near done, and that means ceremonies, gifts, but lots that isn't fun. For everybody seems to want a piece of Poppy's time while he's still here to offer it. Though that might seem sublime to someone younger, Poppy has been famous long enough to know that fame's demands can sometimes get a little tough, especially as there are games that you're still required to play on aching knees and feet that bleeping hurt you every day. I felt I could use bleeping there, since Poppy used it too. If you say that is no excuse, I will defer to you. I guess the moral of this tale, if moral there must be, is that you shouldn't let on when it is that you'll be free of all the daily challenge of the job you've had for years. Announcing your departure may bring lots of cheers and tears, but it will load your plate with obligations not so sweet. And if you hit the ball a lot, despite your aching feet, your fans of each age, size, and shape will all be asking how you can be sitting there and saying, bleep, it's finished now.
Bill Littlefield comments on sports for Morning Edition and hosts Only a Game each Saturday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. The guilty pleasure of admiring unclothed bodies is nothing new. Kathleen Morris is interim senior curator at the Clark Art Institute in Williamstown, which is now exploring how powerful and uncomfortable nude images can be.
Whether it's through the internet or through our entertainment avenues that are risque and erotic. And on the other hand, we come from very puritanical stock. And I think in America in particular, there's always been this kind of tension between those two impulses.
The new exhibition Morris helped put together at the Clark explores how that tension played out in Spain during the repressive Inquisition. WBUR's Andrea Shea reports on the masterworks on loan from a museum in Spain for this new exhibition, which is titled Splendor, Myth, and Vision, Nudes from the Prado.
The first painting you see in the Clark's new exhibition is of the goddess Fortuna by Flemish artist Peter Paul Rubens. There's no shame on her fair-skinned face as she seems to move through the painting in her birthday suit.
She is nearly life-size, full-length, looking directly out at the viewer. This is Rubens' fleshy, robust, confident female nude.
That's Clark curator Laura Yeager-Crisselt. She says, like many of the nudes in this exhibition, Fortuna offers more than a bodacious body. That's how the Spanish kings who collected them saw her, too.
Fortuna represents fortune, chance, luck, fate. She is, you know, the invariability of life. And Rubens shows her bouncing on a crystal ball in a stormy ocean, lightning breaking in the background. So, in fact, she became a source of contemplation for the rulers. So it's this way that the nude is able to operate on many different levels.
Jaeger Christelt says those levels allowed royalty to collect these luscious, some might say lewd works. They're sensual, but also sophisticated and spiritual, depicting stories from mythology and the Bible. King Philip II, and later his grandson, Philip IV, had extreme tastes for top-notch nudes and commissioned them from some of the greatest artists in Europe. How they pulled it off in 16th and 17th century Spain reveals a complicated chapter in history. The Inquisition deemed nudity sinful, and Jaeger Christelt notes that kings were expected to promote morality.
They were Catholic kings, and their roles publicly as representatives, as defenders of the Catholic Church, that public role had to coexist with their private taste.
This exhibition takes a scholarly deep dive into why and how kings collected, displayed, and at times even hid their nudes. They created special private spaces known as salas reservadas. King Philip IV hung Rubens's Fortuna in his hunting lodge.
The king was allowed in there, of course. Close members of the royal family who may have gone hunting with him. A very limited audience.
What about the queen?
The queen was not allowed. And we do have a reference in the earlier part of the 17th century that when the queen did go into a sala reservada, many of these paintings were covered up with a curtain.
Jaeger Christelt says the private viewing rooms evolved over time, depending on who was in power. She and the other curators didn't know they existed until they started developing the show with the Prado Museum. King Philip II created a sala reservata in his palace called the Titian Vaults. One of the most provocative paintings in this show hung there, Venus with an organist and Cupid. In it, a skillfully rendered nude goddess reclines on a luxurious bed.
Venus is lounging, you know, propped up on her side. Her full body is visible for us. There's a sense of softness to it. She has folds in her skin. She's thick in some places. All that she's wearing are jewels, pearls throughout her hair. I mean, she's just adorned by jewels and her own beauty and not much else.
A young musician sits at a pipe organ at the foot of her bed, craning his neck to stare.
He has paused from his playing. You know, she is nude, and he's looking directly at her genitals, basically.
The paintings here aren't just of nude women. There are some barely clad males, too. One painting of Hercules shows the god from behind. His muscular backside is exposed and tensed as he raises a club to defeat his nude opponent. Quite a difference from the sultry, dimpled Venus, a point not lost on museum visitors Jean and Robert Poppy.
It's interesting to come into this room where there's the contrast between the sort of eroticism of the female figure as object and the male body as hero and strong and powerful.
Not that we have that in our society
no,
today.
Of course not.
No.
No, completely foreign to us.
Another visitor, Rachel Cohan, understands how these nudes could be seen as a kind of highbrow porn for the powerful.
Of course, it sounds like pornography of the period of the Spanish Inquisition, right? On the other hand, they're painted by great artists, so there's a lot in them. But it is a really interesting contrast between the rigors of the Inquisition and the existence of these paintings and these guys collecting these paintings.
If they were understood or enjoyed in an erotic way, it doesn't mean I think they could also be enjoyed in a more intellectual way.
This is curator Jaeger Christelt again.
And that's that ambivalence which exists on every level.
What is for sure, though, is that painting a nude was seen as the highest form of artistic achievement, and the kings who collected nudes knew that. By the end of the 17th century, the curator says the publicly pious Catholic monarchs were able to amass more than 5,000 paintings, most of them nudes, despite the Inquisition.
They were just so powerful that they were beyond it.
But not all of the Spanish kings had a thing for nudes. Philip III ordered them removed to protect his virtue. In the 18th century, Kings Charles III and IV tried to destroy the paintings. Court artists saved them in a sala reservada. If they hadn't stashed them away, these masterpieces might not be here to titillate onlookers centuries later in Williamstown. For 90.9 WBUR and The Artery, I'm Andrea Shea.